once a paper being published, that not being the final step, but actually having really useful venues for comments and discourse, maybe in an online setting.
Like YouTube comments? Welcome to Hello PhD, a podcast for scientists and the people who love them. In today's show, we enjoy an herbal summer brew and devise a better way to do peer review on scientific papers. Stay with us.
Welcome back. This is Hello PhD, Episode 5, The Half-Decade Mark. I'm Joshua Hall.
And I'm Daniel Arneman.
And we're here to discuss the human side of lab and science and peel back the layers of the research world.
Josh, how are you this week?
I'm great. Actually, I have some exciting news to share.
I like exciting news.
We got our first iTunes review.
Wow.
And it was actually even a good one.
Oh, that's very surprising then. surprising that someone took the time to leave a review and that it was good. Very nice.
I know. It's the little things, right?
It is.
That actually reminds me to just say thank you to all the early adopters who are out there who have listened and even subscribed to the podcast. We really do love hearing what you think of the show. So if you like what you hear, give us a rating or review on iTunes. That really does help, and we will certainly read it. And
the $100,000 check is sent to the person that left that review, right?
Check's in the mail.
Check's in the mail. It's on its way. Just wait for it.
And, you know, even more important than that, if you're a listener and you know someone else who you think might benefit from some of the things we're talking about here on the podcast, please help us spread the word. We're on Twitter, Facebook. We have a comment section of show notes for each of the shows. So we would love for you to join in the conversation. Spread the word.
Definitely do reply. We'd love to hear from you.
Absolutely. So, Dan, what are we drinking this week?
Well, you requested this one, and it took me a little bit of time to find. This is another local beer. We're really hitting the local beers for some reason, but this is Full Steam Brewery, which is in Durham, North Carolina, and this is the Summer Basil Farmhouse Ale.
I love the summer basil.
You must love the summer basil because you requested it several times. I'm not getting a lot of basil out of it, a little bit of clove and some other things. It tastes Belgian to me.
I don't know. I mean, I think the basil should be in there. I mean, there is a big basil leaf on the label.
There's a drawing of a basil leaf. I don't know if that counts as a flavor.
So I have to admit, I live not too far from Full Steam, and I've had this on draft several times, but this is the first time I've actually seen it in the can, and this is new for me. We have a solid, plain silver can with a label printed out and stuck onto the can.
I think that's an Epson inkjet printer. Somebody kind of did
that. I
believe
it's a dot matrix. Yeah. No, this is interesting. I guess it makes sense.
It's a tall can too. That is actually precisely 1 pint.
Which is?
1 pint. I don't know how many milliliters that is.
16 ounces.
16 ounces?
32 okay. IBUs. But yeah, this has a refreshing summer taste. I'm a big basil fan. I grow a lot of basil in the garden. Love some pesto in the summertime.
But do you taste it in the beer?
You know...
Okay, you're gonna make some kind of long-winded speech about how you think you can almost sense it.
You know, I think I'm getting a little bit of basil in this one. One thing that's interesting, because I've drank my share of summer basil, is for anyone who's grown basil in the garden, it really changes flavor from early season to late season. I feel like it develops a little less of that floral basil flavor, a little more bitter. And the summer basil, I have found, tastes different early in the season.
My gosh.
So I think this is more of a later season hot weather summer basil.
I don't buy it. I think if you were double blinded, you would have no idea that there were basil in it.
Double blinded, you say? That is
a segue
that I'm sure just came off the top of your head.
It just came to me just now.
So we actually got some comments on Twitter this week.
Twitter exploded is what I understand. I don't know a lot about Twitter. I don't use it very often, but I am told Twitter blew up.
Yes, our Twitter feed, we got like one or two tweets about this.
That is incredible. That could have taken tens of seconds to read all of those tweets.
Yeah, it broke the internet. But yeah, we got a tweet that came in from Sonia Hall, at Sonia Hall on Twitter. And Sonia is a postdoc at UMass. And she had a suggestion for something that she thought our listeners might enjoy a discussion about. And that is a discussion about some changes to the peer review process.
Yeah, interesting.
And so I guess to start it off, what started this conversation was the journal Nature.
I haven't heard of that, sorry.
Which, you know, I would say Nature, one of the big two.
What do you mean the big two? I thought it was big three.
Science, Nature.
Cell. Oh, I was a, I was in physiology. See,
there's some bias. There's bias. Okay. But anyway, Nature in March actually began offering an alternative to the conventional peer review. And so I'm sure most of you realize, but the conventional peer review process tends to be a single blind process where the reviewers are actually anonymous, but the reviewers themselves actually know who the authors are.
And so what's the intention there? Why keep a reviewer anonymous and not a writer?
Well, so I think the idea being that potentially a well-known scientist or a paper from... Well, actually, let me give you a good example. So let's say you're a postdoc who's in a really high-power lab. Maybe your boss is a Howard Hughes investigator or a Nobel laureate, and you find that you, as a first author in your high-profile PI's lab, are getting lots of great publications, one after the other. Then you go off and start your own lab. You're the same person, the same scientist, but now you're the last author. It's coming from your name without the name of your hotshot PI.
Okay, and so you get published just the same because you wrote
a
great paper.
No. So then all of a sudden, you are having a harder time getting papers accepted in these high-profile journals than you did when you carried the name of your postdoc mentor. So
okay, so this sounds like this is one of the reasons that people would cite for changing the peer review process, but can we go back to understand why we do peer review in the first place?
Sure, Dan. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about that? I think you did a little bit of reading on that this week.
I did a little bit of reading on it, but and I think peer review is part of the system. So we think about peer review because if I do an experiment, you may have some input on that, or you may have a chance to do the same experiments and catch me on a bad assumption that I did. And this goes way back into history. So even in 1645, when the Royal Society was founded, people like Isaac Newton and Robert Hooke and later people like Benjamin Franklin would get together. They would do these experiments on things that we consider very obvious, and they would discuss them and go over them. So Robert Hooke, who discovered or described the first cells in cork with his microscopes, he demonstrated that a dog could be kept alive with its thorax cut open if you provided ventilation. These are things that nobody knew at the time.
You got to start big to small, the important questions of the day.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a problem that needed to be solved, but
I hope the animal use board approved those experiments.
I doubt that existed, but maybe. So they would get together and they would have these discussion groups, and I'm sure somebody would stand up and say, now, you know, well, that doesn't prove anything. You should have tried it this way. And they would have this debate. The world we live in now, you know, you specialize in such a fine, detailed field. So, you know, I studied a single protein in a particular type of cell. Actually, a single amino acid in that protein formed the basis of my dissertation. So there aren't a lot of people in my area that are going to want to sit down and discuss this with me, probably. And so I want to write that down and have somebody who's an expert give me feedback. I think that's the basis.
Yeah, so it seems like initially there was an importance that was observed by scientists that science and discovery should be a community process, or it should be any scientific finding should be put out there to be tested by others and confirmed.
Ideas get better if they're tested and if other people give feedback. So I think that makes sense.
Yeah, I often like to say science is a team sport.
But in those meetings, there was no blind reviewer. You know, Isaac Newton had to stand up in the back and say, I think your idea is dumb. Here's how you should have done it.
So you think the peer review process as we know it today almost is attempting to serve as proxy for initially what was just conversations among peers?
I think that's right. And if you could convince people in that conversational setting, they may build upon your ideas. But now what we want is a recorded transcript of that debate. And so we write a paper as a scientist, and then other scientists record their impressions of it and their feedback on it. and then we try to make it better.
But I think one of the issues might be, and I might be getting a little bit ahead of myself, but the sheer volume of scientific papers that comes out now is staggering. I mean, if you look at the number of journals, the number of articles, I know any new student joining a lab who tries to get on PubMed and learn from scratch on any given topic, it can be very overwhelming. It seems like once a paper is published, you get through the peer review process, your article is published. That almost seems like that's kind of the end of the conversation. There doesn't seem to be, at least in the way the system has been, any ongoing discussion or really any good means for having a continued discussion on something once it's published.
Well, I think that's fair. And the way that the blind review is conducted, that review isn't actually recorded in that public record. So if somebody looks at your paper and they say, you stretched too far in this conclusion, you should really do it this way, all you do is rewrite it and resubmit it. There's no record that that conversation went on at all. People just see what got published. So I think we do lose a little bit in the current process.
Yeah, I read a great article this week from PLOS Medicine, and this was by Hilda Bastian. And we'll post this on the website in the show notes. But the title was A Stronger Post-Publication Culture is Needed for Better Science. And what Hilda was talking about was really the need for, once a paper being published, that not being the final step, but actually having really useful venues for comments and discourse, maybe in an online setting.
Like YouTube comments?
I think they're,
Ron Paul 2012,
you know,
on,
I think,
every paper that's published.
I think some of the criticism about doing this is fear that will happen, because we very much do have, all of us have this really familiarity with comments on the internet. But I think as a scientific community, there are ways that you can filter some of those out.
Yeah, the internet originally belonged to scientists. That's who wrote the internet to be able to have these not to have these conversations, but it was to connect research centers. So let's take it back.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Could you imagine, let's say you're a grad student and you read this paper that's related to what you're doing, and if there was actually a useful way for you to go to the website of the journal where the paper was published, and you could say, you know, figure two, I'm trying to repeat this, and I'm having a hard time getting this experiment to go this way based on these conditions. And actually, what if the author, or one of the authors, the people that actually did the work, there was a way you could dialogue with them in that venue, or other people could easily observe that conversation or jump in and say, well, you know, why don't you try this or that, or, well, this is my thought on that.
Yeah, that sounds ideal. I deal a lot in, because I do some programming now, there's a website called Stack Overflow. And if you have a question as a programmer, somebody has answered it on Stack Overflow. Or if they haven't, they will answer it. And it's exactly that. The quality of the content's very high, and people help each other. There could be 10 answers, and the best one kind of bubbles up to the top. So that's the one I see when I go search for that thing online. I think that makes a lot of sense.
You know, I could imagine, as I'm thinking through this,
let's start this and make $1 million.
Well, actually, there are some journals that are doing this, and I'll talk about that in just a second.
They owe us royalties for $1 million.
I had this thought a long time ago.
Yeah, we recorded it.
But what I was thinking was, you know, as a grad student, I published some papers, and, you know, I was wondering how I would feel as a grad student if I put my paper out there knowing that individuals were going to read it and then make public comments on my work. That's scary.
That is scary, but that is the Royal Society. That is showing up and saying, I want to test the effect of gravity at the bottom of a well to see if it's stronger or weaker there. And having people tell you, it's not easy.
Yeah, and you know, there's been a lot that's been published lately about the number of studies, even high-profile studies, that individuals have had trouble repeating or that have had to have been withdrawn. And I wonder if, as someone working in the lab, if I knew that my research was going to be put up to this sort of public scrutiny, that might actually be a good...
You may hesitate before you...
Yeah, to do better science. And it seems like science would win and become better by having a system that really did have better, a stronger post-publication culture for discourse and dialogue.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think what we're highlighting here are some of the unintended consequences of the existing peer review process. So we talked about people aren't repeating experiments, and there are, you know, there are some kind of famous analyses of experiments that cannot be repeated, and a large number of them can't be repeated when people try them. I think there's an issue with a reviewer who kind of wants to, they have to say something. So I don't know if you've ever had the environmental health and safety people come around and inspect the lab.
Yeah, that's why I would always keep a pair of closed-toed shoes in my drawer so I could ditch the sandals and put those on.
Not a bad idea. But they have never come through the lab and said, hey, you're doing everything perfect. You have to find something. So if somebody presents you a paper and you're a reviewer, you're not going to say, yeah, looks pretty good, thanks. Like, you have to provide a comment.
That's true.
And so we're kind of creating this incentive where to look like a good reviewer, maybe you're generating a long list of comments, or you're saying you should have tried these 1,500 experiments that you know are not reasonable, but it makes you feel smart as a person to say that.
Well, and would you say that with the current system, that as a reviewer, you have this added weight because really the buck stops with you? You are probably the last person who is likely to have some sort of commentary on the piece of work that's going to be published.
I think that makes a lot of sense, yeah. But you could also have conflicts of interest. So they don't ask a microbiologist to review a paper on a physiology subject. What if it's a competing lab and you're doing some of the similar research that they're doing? Do you really want to give them an easy pass on their paper?
Well, and I think that goes back to what nature is trying to combat, and that is by having a double-blind process, you might eliminate some of those biases that could happen.
But even that, you know, so that's not a bias. If I read the paper and it's about Toxoplasma gondii, and that's my research field, it doesn't matter who you are, I may not want you to publish it. But what you're talking about is an actual bias where I read your name on the paper and I have some problem with you, either consciously or subconsciously. And that's what you brought up in the beginning. I think it's called the junior faculty problem. You move from the first author to the last author, and now you lose the impact of that famous lab name on your paper.
Yeah, and I want to talk for just a second about some of the criticism that people have had to what Nature is doing. I mean, on one hand, you know, I think it's very commendable that a journal that it says high profile as Nature is trying out something, is experimenting with changes to the review process. They realize there are some broken pieces, and you know, certainly if a journal like Nature made some changes, there are going to be some other journals that are going to take a look at their own review process. But you know, I read an article, a commentary by Lenny Tettleman, who is a co-founder of Protocols.io, and he actually jumped in on the Twitter conversation this week that was really exciting.
One of the two tweets.
One of the single digits of tweets.
I'm counting them on my hand right now.
But he actually had a great commentary on the spectroscope, and I just want to read a quote from him. He said, "So why am I skeptical? It's the way Nature is doing this. They're offering the option of double-blind submission to the author. Who exactly will be opting for this, the HHMI lab, the high-profile lab, or the junior faculty? The same exact bias will persist. And I think that's a great point. Right now, what Nature's playing with is the option to get a double-blind review, but if I'm the big-name PI, of course I'm not going to opt for...
It's the same as kind of pleading the fifth, right? If you were innocent, you don't plead the fifth. If you're not innocent, you plead the fifth, and everybody knows you're not innocent.
Yeah, and you know, another thing that was interesting to me when I was reading Hilda Bastian's article is, again, a lot of what we're focusing on is trying to level the playing field for you know, earlier career researchers, junior faculty, maybe people who are new to a field who might have different ideas that could challenge some of the dogma of different research areas. But one thing that Hilda brought up that I thought was really interesting, if we were to move towards a post-publication culture where there was more open and ongoing dialogue, we would also need to make sure that there were not fears of repercussions by junior faculty from actually calling to question or having comments on a high-profile paper. I want to just read a quote from Hilda. She said, "The fear of repercussions for junior scientists in particular is high. This fear lies at the heart of the contentious issue of anonymous post-publication commenting. Some argue, though, that the risks for young scientists of openly commenting on others' work do not necessarily outweigh the advantages of visibility and recognition. However, she states, rewards for substantive intellectual effort post-publication and for the aftercare of research publications and sharing data would help. Formal recognition is also necessary to undo the perverse incentive for authors to keep important insights and additional data until a subsequent publication. Such delays can last for months, if not years. And, you know, that's actually a really fascinating point, because a lot of times, as a scientist, you may say, well, we've got enough here for two stories, so we're going to hold back the really good stuff until that next publication. But is that what's best for science?
Yeah, there is a lot of gamesmanship in the process, where I'm trying to put my best pieces on the board and move them in such a way that I get more papers, which is my currency, but I'm not really considering how does this benefit science or society as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I actually wanted to, I said I was going to mention this, but as we talk about the post, some post commentary on publications, I mentioned there were some journals that are starting to go this direction, and one of them is from Public Library of Science, and that's PLOS One. And so I feel like there is not a more divisive publication topic than how people feel about PLOS One. Have you heard of PLOS One, Dan? You've been out of the academic world for a little bit.
Okay, usually when I say I've never heard of Nature, I'm joking, but PLOS One, I mean, I've heard of it, but I don't know a lot about the controversy.
Yeah, so I've heard a lot of more senior scientists refer to PLOS One as the journal that doesn't review their papers.
Oh, I definitely have followed this idea that you can just publish anything you want now in some online journal that no one's ever heard
of.
Yeah,
and that's not true. And so, you know, one thing that I think is important to realize is this is not just some out there group of people. I mean, this is PLOS, you know.
Spoken by a person who's out there, trying to defend an out there.
But many of the other Public Library of Science journals are actually very high impact factor journals. And so PLOS One, I actually went to their website to read specifically what they say about who they are and what they're trying to do. So let me just read this really quick. This is from the PLOS One review criteria page. Often a journal's decision not to publish a paper reflects an editor's opinion about what is likely to have substantial impact in a given field. These subjective judgments can delay the publication of work that later proves to be of major significance. PLOS One will rigorously peer review your submission and publish all papers that are judged to be technically sound. Judgments about the importance of any particular paper are then made after publication by the readership, who are the most qualified to determine what is of interest to them.
I mean, that makes sense to me. If a paper is technically sound, put it out there. If it's not interesting, no one will cite it.
And would you say, you did a little more reading than I did about the early days of peer review with the Royal Society. Would you say what PLOS One is doing is actually getting closer to what these early scientists were actually doing with their peers?
I mean, these early scientists were personally motivated and interested in whatever their particular field mm-hmm. was. So they did all sorts of different things. I suspect that somebody might stand up in the back and say, oh, I did this experiment on, you know, sea slugs, and maybe nobody cared about it. But in that culture, in that society, they would probably hear him out on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, what PLOS is trying to do is really minimize the impact of subjective judgment. Because really, you know, a lot of what these issues with the peer review system that we're talking about have to do with either bias of who the reviewer thinks the author is or how capable they are, or really it could be a judgment about, well, you did the experiments well, but we don't think this is important. But really, if a reviewer decides something's not important, the end result of that is it doesn't get published. If it doesn't get published, then the rest of the science community will never have a chance to, to see those results and maybe benefit from them.
And that's got to be a throwback to the days when published means printed on paper, when you had a limited amount of space and you had to pick the most important science that was coming out. In the days when it's on the internet, publishing means, you know, people can have a podcast if they feel like it, right? You know, we're taking up bits and bytes, but, you know, if we were going to take up, you know, tape reel or something, people might say, oh, this is too small a niche of people who are getting PhDs. Maybe you shouldn't have a podcast. But the reality is the internet has made the world wide open. So
And you will decide if this podcast is worth sticking around.
And you should decide what science is interesting.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, as I was reading this, it really made me think of a real-life situation that I encountered as a graduate student. And that is, when I was a second-year grad student, there was another student in my lab who was also a second year. So we were pretty new to the lab. And so my friend, what her task was initially was to repeat this experiment that had been published. And she worked on it and worked on it and just could not repeat the results. And as a beginning graduate student to the field, her viewpoint on what was going on was that she must be making a mistake because this paper, this result was a certain way. The results she was getting were something different, so she must be making an error. So she really spent a lot of time trying to reproduce these results that were published. Well, it turns out, you know, fast forward a couple years, and multiple other people began to publish the opposite result of what she was trying to repeat, which were exactly the same results that she was getting. Now, had there been a venue like PLOS ONE where you could actually publish things like negative results, right, she may have wasted a lot less time not trying to repeat something just because it was published thinking it was correct.
Right, but who's going to believe a new graduate student's results over a published paper?
You know, I think a take-home message and something, you know, I think more senior scientists always try to impress upon younger scientists is just because something's on paper, just because something's published, does not necessarily mean, you know, it's dogma at that point. It's the gospel truth, right? And so I think having a better commenting discourse system in place might actually make scientific discovery move faster.
So I'm totally with you, but and there are some improvements I think we can make to the process with the post-publication discourse, but we haven't yet covered a very real bias, which is the bias we see against women, against minorities. So there is lots of interesting and valuable research about how different people groups are treated subconsciously in the literature and in hiring practices. We're not going to try and cover hiring practices today, but I did pull a couple of resources for how publications are affected. There's a 2008 study. We'll link all of these on the show notes. A 2008 study showed that if you remove author information, you increase the proportion of female first authors being accepted or published, which should astound all of us.
Yeah, I mean, if there's not, positive reinforcement for having a double-blind review, I mean, I don't know what else you would have besides
that. Yeah, the only difference is you take the first name off that is obviously a woman's name, and now this paper is accepted for publication. There was a JAMA study showing that U.S. reviewers favor U.S. papers. I mean, this is not racial particularly, but it is national. And then there was a really cool article that was published in the early 80s that showed, so they took existing published papers, they changed the names in the organizations to things like Tri-Valley Center for Human Potential, and they resubmitted them. And those papers, by and large, were rejected because they didn't come from these big places. And they got comments like, these have fundamental methodological flaws and other errors. So basically, are scientists just terrible, mean, biased, racist, sexist people?
I don't think so. But I think there's a lot of research out there on implicit bias, that it's a real thing. And I think, you know, as scientists, we should love data. And the fact that there is a lot of data out there that even well-meaning people are going to have their own biases, then why would we not do something to try to overcome these things? I mean, if there's, you know, if there's results out there that say we make a lot of decisions not at all based on the merit of scientific discovery, but just based on someone's name, why would we not make changes? We should demand changes in the name of science to do that.
Yeah, even if you don't think that you have these biases, and in fact, the research shows that people who don't think these have these biases do have them. Even if you don't think you do, recognize that it's inherently a part of people. We take shortcuts, we take mental shortcuts, and we don't even know we're doing it. And so there are some things we can do to eliminate this in our own our own thought process. And so one is the double blind. And I think it's an interesting, from a game theory perspective, it makes sense. Now you no longer know these demographic pieces of information about the paper you're reviewing.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And you know, this whole conversation made me think we've really focused on the peer review process for publication, but it's really a similar process for grant funding as well.
Yeah, it makes sense. And there's money on the table.
Yeah, and there was actually a really high-profile study that came out in Science in 2011 that made a huge splash, and that was looking at the racial distribution of NIH grants that were distributed. And what these researchers found was that actually white researchers receive NIH grants at nearly twice the rate as African-American researchers. And even, you know, even when the researchers controlled for things like the publication record, the training, African-American scientists were still only two-thirds as likely as a white scientist to be funded. And this made a huge impression on the leaders at NIH, and they actually are spending a lot of money to develop, as the government does, and to develop a working group to look at ways to change it. And they're actually thinking about putting in place a more double-blinded, grant review process as well.
That's really good. And that lines up with some of the research that was done on hiring practices, where you take the same resume, you put a traditionally African-American first name on it, mm-hmm. or a traditionally European or white American name on it, and the hiring rate is, you know, 50% lower if it's an African-American name. It's, you know, it's a different study, but it's the same result.
You know, I was at a conference just today, and we were discussing the recent paper that did that same study, but with, they took the same resume and used a female first name versus a male first name. And the interesting thing that made me think about was that female PIs were just as likely to discriminate against the female name as male PIs. So I think what that gets at is, again, not that scientists in particular are necessarily bad people or want to have these biases, but it's just an innate feature of being human that we have these biases that exist. And again, we should do something about it. So I think, you know, to bring it back to what nature's trying to do to institute double-blind peer review in their own process, it seems like the take-home might be kudos to them for trying to make a change and address some of these, but maybe they're not going far enough. I was a fan of PLOS One. I was on Team PLOS One and what they were trying to do for a long time. And the more I kind of read about what they're trying to do and read some of these other commentaries and articles, I think maybe that's the future, that what is the role of a reviewer? I mean, maybe if the role of the reviewer is to really just establish, was, you know, here's an expert in this field, was this science done in a sound way? And then that's published with, obviously, the authors of the paper. That's public information. I believe with PLOS, the reviewers, I believe that's also out there. And then the dialogue, let the scientific community decide if things were done well or not well, or things are important or not important. You know, really just have it as open as possible, because I think really that fits with the heart of what the scientific community is all about.
We could probably talk about this for the next 6 to 10 years, but let's allow the listeners to weigh in. Go to the website, tweet us, talk to us on Facebook, and tell us what is your ideal solution to the peer review gamesmanship problem, and how would you solve it?
Yeah, and also wanted to say thanks to Sonia for bringing up this topic. This was a really interesting thing to think about and discuss this week, and so thanks to her. And if you guys have anything else that you're thinking about that you'd like to discuss, please let us know.
Sounds good. So I made a bit of a change to the etymology section of the show.
Oh.
I had an insight this week. I was doing the crossword puzzle, like I do.
You like a good crossword puzzle.
I do.
I'm terrible at crossword puzzles.
It doesn't matter. It's fun to do. Do you like to do them or not?
I do. I do enjoy it, actually. I enjoy the Monday ones.
Oh, I don't do New York Times. I'm not that good.
Because they're easy, and yeah. I feel good about myself.
I was relaxing doing the crossword puzzle, and one of the clues pointed to a science word. And the answer I didn't realize the origin of, but I got it through the crossword puzzle. And then it occurred to me, what if I turned the etymology section of the show into a puzzle so that other puzzle-minded people could participate with me?
And if you're not a puzzle-minded person,
then ignore the next section.
Cool. So this is like a game.
It's a bit like a game.
Contest.
Yeah. It's like a contest.
I like that.
So here's how it's going to work. You're going to have to put on your thinking cap. I will give you a clue that contains the literal meaning of a scientific word. And then your job is to tell me the word I'm thinking of. So you're going to get this clue will contain the kind of interpretation of the science word. You tell me the science word, and you could win.
What's the prize?
I haven't decided yet. We'll see if anybody actually participates.
Sounds good.
If nobody participates, the prize is $10 million. If one person participates, it's much lower.
Sounds fair.
Okay, fantastic. So this week's clue actually comes from some of my research on the Royal Society. And here's your clue. This book, published by the Royal Society, must have contained very small handwriting. Okay, I'll read it one more time. This book, published by the Royal Society, must have contained very small handwriting. So if you think you know the answer, email it to puzzle@hellophd.com. We'll select a winner randomly from the correct answers.
That sounds exciting. Can I enter?
Do you think you know the answer?
No, actually, I don't think I do. So.
Okay, so no worries there.
But I will put on my thinking cap. Wow, what a great show. That was a really exciting discussion. I enjoyed that, Dan.
I was glad to be here for it. And we got through our summer basil pint.
Yes, delicious. So if you're in the North Carolina area, check out some full steam summer basil. And we will see you next week.
See you next week.